right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a packed show for you today, and one we're going to be running right down to the wire on, all right? At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Joshua Oppenheimer. Josh is the director and writer of The Act of Killing, and most recently, The Look of Silence. The Look of Silence is now up for an Academy Award, and I had the chance to talk with Josh right after I returned from Sundance Film Festival, and we dove into a lot of the questions posed by his film and life in general, the world in general today, all right? And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to bring you an interview I did with Brian Oakes. Brian is the director of a film called Jim, the James Foley story, and it's about the young journalist who was killed by ISIS, about a year and a half ago. And this film tells the story of Jim's life, why he did what he did in terms of being a journalist in conflict zones around the world, and why people need to know about him, all right? So this is an interview I did up at the Sundance Film Festival with Brian Oakes and Claire Gillis shortly after seeing the film. Claire is a journalist that worked with Jim in the Middle East. So check this out. All right, I'm sitting here with Brian Oakes, who's the director of a film I saw at Sundance called Jim, the James Foley story, and Claire Gillis, who's a journalist, who's in the Middle East with Jim for a number of times, I guess, right? People who don't know the Jim Foley story, Brian, why don't you tell people what that is?
Sure. James Foley was the first American journalist that was killed by ISIS in 2014. He was also a dear, dear friend of mine. I'd known him since we were 7 years old, growing up in Wolfboro, New Hampshire, a small little rural town in New England. So it's a very personal story for me to take on.
What made you want to do this story, though? I mean, he's your friend, and he's a journalist, and he was killed. You weren't a filmmaker before you did this.
Yeah, I wasn't a filmmaker. I was in the film industry. My background is actually graphics and animation. And I've just recently had transitioned into directing over the last couple of years. It's my first film that I solo directed. My motivation for the film was, there's many reasons why I made the film, but my original motivation came out of about 2 or 3 months after Jim had been killed. I was just very uncomfortable with the way that James, the image of James Foley that we all have come to know, was being used in whether for political agendas or sensationalistic articles and information, potentially inaccurate stories. He became kind of more of an image than a person. And so I felt a responsibility to Jim and to family and friends of those of us who knew him and loved him, that I wanted to show people and tell people who he was and what he was doing in Syria, which was very, very important stories as a journalist, as Claire can attest to. She's doing the same things. And in an effort to do that, to kind of recontextualize that image of Jim. So when you know who he was and you see where he came from, you see that image in a completely different way.
You know, one thing that really struck me is that when you did the film, you know, you could have easily been pulled in the direction of sort of just going into, I don't know, you know, the whole thing of like, okay, this was her, and it was a heinous murder. But you could have concentrated on that alone and just told a story that was very one-dimensional. But you really chose to actually give people a fuller picture of this, including, I thought, the drive that he had around the work that he was doing. You know, because that's sort of, to me, that was the heart of what it was. I mean, people don't, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but you don't just go out in the world and throw everything on the line because you're bored.
Yeah. So Jim's death and his execution was not an intention to talk about in the film. I mean, it's obviously the end of his life, but it's insignificant in the sense of the bigger scope of what the film is about. What Jim was doing and what Claire and Manu Bravo, Nicole Tung, and Zach Bailey, who are the other journalists in the film, their work is extremely important for the world. I mean, I remember Nicole telling me there's a saying that conflict journalists, you know, who are on the front line, they're writing the first draft of history. And, you know, without these images and without these videos, we as a civilization don't know what's going on. And if we don't know what's going on, that can be a very dangerous world to live in. And so for Jim and his colleagues to be on the front lines, risking their lives to bring us these stories, is extremely important for the world to see. And in Jim's case, specifically what he was doing in Syria with the stories of the civilians, you know, these stories that he was telling are extremely relevant maybe even more now so than when he was doing this 3 years ago, because of what we're seeing with the Syrian refugee crisis, which is the largest refugee crisis since World War II.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Claire, let's talk about your experience with Jim. And I have a number of questions off this, but one of the things is, and you're featured prominently in the film, and you know, you spent a lot of time in the same parts of the world as he did, doing the same thing. And there's always this question that I've noticed just in reading even what people are saying about the film and listening to people after it. There's still always this question that I think, Brian, you started to speak to, but I think there's still a lot more there. People keep posing this question of, why are you doing this? His family posed it throughout the entire thing. Why the hell is he going back there? You know, what? But there's something more than just sort of like being amped up on the need for, you know, constant tension and danger and all this stuff. There's something, I think, much deeper that goes into being a conflict journalist, being a journalist in general, generally, if you're doing anything that means anything, than being a conflict journalist, which is one of the most difficult things I think there is to be in journalism.
When you see a situation where you see literally millions of refugees streaming across a border, maybe with a suitcase, maybe with shoes, maybe without shoes, there's an obvious humanitarian imperative to take care of these people. And for some of us, our first question is like, wow, they're really running away fast. What could be so bad? What's actually happening there? We need to understand that better. As Brian just mentioned, the refugee crisis, I think it's essential at times like this, when you have a potential presidential candidate who wants to ban Muslims from entering the country, what are these people running away from? They're running away from hell. They're leaving hell. And we know that. Why? Because of the work that Jim has done, because of the work that all of our colleagues have done to document what's happening inside that country. The people who run into a burning building versus the people who run out of a burning building, that's a kind of fundamental personality thing. I think you can't really ever explain to someone else why you feel the way you feel. But when you have that curiosity and you're able to live it out, it's incredibly, incredibly powerful to be in a position where you can actually see what's going on, and then you really understand a little bit better. I mean, look at, you know, people getting on these tiny little rafts that don't even, you know, you wouldn't smuggle liquor in that thing and try to get across the sea. The risk of death is so high. What makes someone want to do that? I want to know. I want to know what's so bad that makes that the better option.
Claire had a really amazing story that we unfortunately could not fit into the film. I had to, you obviously have to choose your stories, and maybe she can tell it now, was the story when you were with the Libyan rebel in the desert who you were talking to and ran off, and it's a really powerful story.
Yeah. So this is in the very early days of the conflict in Libya, and it was before NATO had become involved, so before the airstrikes started, and Gaddafi's warplanes were still carrying out airstrikes. So I was down at the front lines one day, and you know, with a number of other journalists, and we were with rebels, and we heard an airplane start circling overhead, and we all kind of started running. You don't know where to run. There's nowhere to run. Like, it's not logical. You're in the middle of the desert. It could hit you at any point. You just feel like you want to run. And one of the young men who I was talking to, he and I were just chatting. He was like, yeah, you know, I've got this like 3-week-old daughter who I've barely seen, and my wife, and I don't know what comes next. And I asked him, you know, how long have you been doing this? And he's like, I don't know, a week, 10 days. Well, time doesn't mean anything for us anymore. And we have nowhere to go but forward. And then the plane started circling again, and we ran in different directions, and that was the last I saw of him.
Wow. You know, one thing, when I was talking earlier, that you reminded me of when you said that you didn't want to have this like sort of exploitative thing going on. And to me, it's really interesting, because the way you did the film and not having the beheading and the aftermath, the gruesome aftermath of that, and making a conscious decision that wasn't going to be on there. And it struck me as I'm watching the film and listening to you talk afterwards, the idea that this could have gone two ways. This could have been a jingoistic, and like you were saying earlier, that it could have been anything. It could have been people, you know, this rallying cry for war, send more troops to the Middle East, anything. And it's been done. We've seen it done many, many times over and over again, where these things that happen to people who are doing basically objectively very good things and are consciously doing it because they want to do that, then everything that their life has been about gets turned around. And I really admired you not including that gruesome footage, because not only because it just, you didn't want to reduce his life to that, but it also raised some bigger questions, I think, in terms of what are you putting forward in terms of what a person's life is about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was never my intention to use that again. It's not a part of the story of Jim, and yeah, it's pretty simple. I would never, you know, never would have any reason to use that.
And journalists immediately, once the footage was made public, there was an immediate backlash against any outlet that did publish that image or those videos. Mm-hmm. And it was a fairly universal decision to just use the images of Jim in the field at work and not this, you know, final act.
I think the other thing is that another reason, other than the main one, but what you can access on the internet now is extremely powerful and graphic imagery, especially now that we've seen videos from jihadist groups, and not only jihadist groups, but videos from American kids uploading things. I mean, it's just the Wild West. And we have a choice, an individual choice, of whether or not we want to watch that. And I'm not going to show something that's graphic or controversial or and take that choice away from someone who might choose to watch this film. So it's just kind of another, it does raise the question of responsibility of when you watch something or when you choose to watch something on the internet or on television, I think we have a responsibility to understand where that is coming from, who's behind the camera of that footage or of that photograph, and understanding where that is coming from and what is the intention of it. Because I think once you're able to at least understand the perspective of a piece of media or a piece of news, I think that's really important for understanding what's real and what's not, and making decisions about what you choose to believe.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Brian Oakes and Claire Gillis. Brian is the director of the film Jim, the James Foley story, which tells the story of the life and murder of journalist Jim Foley. And Claire Gillis is a journalist who worked with Jim during that time. Claire, let me ask you this. I kept thinking, and you, Brian, you included this in your film, the Nick Ott photo of the woman, the young girl running down the street on fire in Vietnam, which was, you know, again, that was showing something that was really horrific and needed to be shown. And I kept thinking about this in relation to some things you were saying, and I think you were saying too, that this is what Jim Foley's life was actually about, was actually bringing knowledge to people about what was true and what wasn't true, what was happening to people, and in a certain sense, opening a door for people to find out why it was happening, and giving people what they needed to really analyze the world and to do something. So I wanted to ask you about that in relation to Jim and in relation to yourself.
Okay, and what was the question exactly?
Ah, come on. Well, just this idea, this point about, you know, people are doing this because they want to bring truth out.
Yes.
And they really want to bring truth out. And it seems like it trumps everything, which I think it should. You want people to know about this. And so you have Jim Foley, who, in fact, I think actually it was quoted somewhere, it says, and I don't know whether you said this, but that he would not want to be the story. And was it you?
That may well have been me. Oh. And that's a standard thing that journalists say. Mm-hmm. You write the story, you tell the story, you do not want to be the story. And Jim, yeah, he would have been very disturbed to know that his death had turned into a propaganda tool, had turned into the topic of conversation when it comes to Syria. This was ISIS's kind of, I don't know, announcement, coming out party, whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
I think that the historical photos from, you know, the Normandy and the Vietnam, my intention of showing those was actually during Manu Bravo, who's a photojournalist and colleague of Claire and Jim's. And he's talking about how what he does matters. And he doesn't do it for $300 a day. He doesn't do it for the money. He does it because it's transcendental for him. And when he's at the end of his life, he wants to know that he's done something for society. And that's, to me, like, that's a very historical point of view. And so he might be taking photos in Syria, but what he's doing has been happening for decades throughout war. When you're trying to answer the question of, like, why is he going back in there? Journalists have been going back in there for centuries. Conflict journalism has existed, and that's how we have images of World War II. And that's, they're writing history, they're documenting history. And so, of course, they're going to go back in there because that's the job and that's what's important. It's not anything new. We've been doing it. It's changed. The landscape has changed.
But you know what's interesting? Is that today, the ability of people like yourself, Claire, to do this is getting smaller and smaller. I mean, you can go and do it, but the point was made many times in the film is that you're actually living on shoe leather in terms of being able to even survive, not because of the danger, but also because of, look, this is a society that does manufactured news. We know all about Trump and every other, you know, political, Republican political candidate, the Democratic Party's political candidate, what each argument is. And then we know a certain picture of what's happening in places like the Middle East, you know, what's happening in places like Africa. But that picture is filtered through all these journalists who, when I was in South Africa, it was very, very heavy. Most of the journalists that were supposed to be covering these uprisings, they would sit in the bar in Johannesburg and they would pay kids to come in and tell them what happened in the townships these days. And these kids were smart because they said, we don't have to go out to the townships. We can all get paid. We just go in, we all tell them the same thing and they give us the money, you know? But the journalists were putting that out as news. And then it was also shaped by their own political conceptions of what should be the news, which I thought what you brought out in the film and what you lived and what Jim lived and the rest of the people that were with you was something that was in diametrically opposed to that kind of stand on journalism. And I think that's critical and very needed in the world today.
It's very needed in the world today, and it is profoundly, disastrously underfunded. And one of the main things, one of the main things that I think the movie gets across, one of the main issues that the Foley Legacy Foundation addresses is the need to support freelancers adequately as we work in these areas. Because if you don't have enough money to take care of your basic safety needs, like buy a flak jacket, hire a reliable fixer translator, stay in a hotel that's safe, then you put yourself at risk by working on that kind of a shoestring budget.
I would add to that, and I think also there is a need for socially people to actually to have that social, that societal support for people that are doing this work that actually says, look, this is journalism and this needs to be done. If we don't have this, we really don't know what the hell is happening in the world. We have to take this sort of manufactured news as like the best we can do.
Yeah, or just, you know, have a few interviews on Skype with someone inside Syria. And this is legitimately some of the best ways that we can get news from inside Syria at this point in time, is Skype interviews with trusted contacts, because the number of journalists on the ground there now is just minuscule, because it's become far too dangerous.
We have time for, I think, one more question, because I'm looking at it's almost 20 minutes, and we'll sneak a couple of extra ones. You told this story by weaving together three stories. And, I mean, you had the part with the people that were in prison with him the last time he was in prison. You had the part with the people like Claire and others who were active in the field with him. And then you had the family and friends. And what was your intention in bringing, I mean, it seems like a simple question because I know it does create the full person, but it seems like it's really important because you didn't lose what's actually the main thread. And I say that having thought of, I heard Haskell Wexler play an interview he did with Jim in some demonstration in Chicago a number of years ago.
It was the NATO.
Right. And I thought that was really remarkable, actually, you know, because Haskell was an irascible guy. He basically got there and he wanted to, he said, look, I want people to know that it's not what's being said about Jim. This isn't what he was about. This is, I did this interview and this actually tells you more about what his soul was about, what his heart was about. And I thought that that's some of what you managed to do by interweaving these three stories, but never losing that main thread of what his life was about.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think, but I mean, that's not a testament to my storytelling. I mean, that was Jim. I mean, Jim did not change his characteristics through anybody, with his family and his colleagues, his friends, and ultimately in captivity, what we discovered. All of the values that he had, and then all the characteristic traits that he had, he carried into any situation that he had. I mean, he was a teacher for Teach for America in Phoenix, Arizona. And then he taught in the Chicago prison systems in Cook County Boot Camp. He was history and literature. And we learned that he gave literature lectures in captivity. He was a mentor to his students. And obviously we found out through talking to his former hostages that he was a big support system, one of the pillars of the 19 hostages in that system. So what I learned about Jim actually was not, what I learned about Jim during those 2 years of captivity was not surprising at all, because it was just a carrying over of everything that I knew about him already. And so it's nicely woven between family and colleagues and friends and former hostages, because all of Jim's characteristics kind of complete everybody, you know, in that world. So,
you know, one thing in relation to that, I think it's, and this will be for you the last question, I guess, but, and it's probably two parts, but it's, you know, the one thing coming off of that is that also what came out of that and all the things that went to make him up, then you'd step back and you look at what he's doing with his journalism. And it's true, you don't go into something, even if you have a side. I mean, like I told you, I've reported for a long time, and I know I have a side generally, but I don't allow that to determine the truth of what's going on. You have to look for truth in what's actually happening. You have to understand that. But I thought that actually the thing that oftentimes gets lost when we talk about people like Jim or when not enough people who actually understand it deeply talk about it, but the fact that I think it came out a couple times in the film, where he wanted the people here to even understand the relationship between what this country does in the Middle East, you know, and how that gives rise to, even frankly, I think even in something like ISIS, you know, it's a reaction to some stuff that not some specific policy, but decades long, you know, savaging of the Middle East. And of course, people are going to rise up. Now they rise up and take up really reactionary things a lot of times. Sometimes they don't. But let's talk about that a little bit. The idea of actually, there's a humanitarian aspect to what you're doing, but there's also something about wanting the truth and actually then not being afraid to say, look, we want the people here that is our audience to understand even the relationship between what the U.S. does in this place and what's happening in these places, because that's a big part of the truth that gets covered up by things like the mainstream press that's just sort of, it's all... You can read every major paper in the U.S. today, and every front page is pretty much 95% the exact same story. So what about that in terms of that, you know, what that means for people? You know, like yourself, you know, you don't just go in and say, I'm going to report on whatever. You actually have something urging you on of what you want to bring out. And I thought in Jim's case, it was actually what came out to me in the film was actually the idea that he did want the truth, and he wanted the truth no matter where it went, including pointing out this stuff about this country does some pretty damn bad things around the world, and he was going to reveal that.
Exactly, and he spent time in Iraq as well. So I think his understanding of, for example, U.S. actions in Iraq and how they affected subsequent developments in that country and in Syria, obviously, I think it informed him deeply. And his focus was in most cases just on the civilian tragedies, and so much of what gets filmed and photographed is the sort of frontline bang bang, guys shooting at each other, something on fire, somebody running, and that fully obscures the fact that 90 to 95% of any casualties in any war are civilians, and it ruins their lives. I mean, it ruins their lives either because it ends it or because it destroys the fabric of the society. And Jim had a really keen sense of that.
All right, thank you very much. And Claire Gillis, really glad I got a chance to speak to you today.
Thank you.
And Brian Oakes, I want to ask you one more question. When the hell is this thing going to air, man?
Well, we got lucky. HBO is distributing the film, and they're going to air it on February 6th on HBO. And, of course, after that, plug into HBO Go, and you can watch it whenever you want.
There you go. And you should, okay? All right, Brian,
thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Okay.
All right, that was an interview I did at Sundance Film Festival with Brian Oakes, the director of the film Jim, the James Foley story, and Claire Gillis, one of the journalists that worked with Jim Foley in the Middle East. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with my conversation with Joshua Oppenheimer, so stay tuned. Welcome back. Now we're going to be listening to an interview I did with Joshua Oppenheimer about his film, The Look of Silence. And that film is up for an Academy Award this year. I had a chance to hear Josh up at the Sundance Film Festival and interview him a short time after we returned. And this is our conversation about all the big questions posed coming off of his film, The Look of Silence. So check this out. Joshua, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. We got limited time, and I got 1,000 questions, so I'm going to jump into it right now. The first thing I want to talk about is your two Hallmark films, The Act of Killing and The Look of Silence. Both films that were stunning. In an eerie way, they were really beautiful. They were also very powerful and really kind of, they captured so much that was, I don't know how to describe it. It's sort of like so much that was sort of like the bottom of society in a certain sense. The worst that it could get, the monstrous killings of what, almost 1 million people in Indonesia, people who were communists, who were activists, who were just swept up in even people seeking revenge or whatever. And you turned them into something that people could look at and be both amazed by, but also horrified by. I want to ask you two things. One, what compelled you to actually dig into those two subjects?
Well, I think what really compelled me was the sense that the perpetrators are still in power and not facing justice. And as a consequence, they've never been forced to admit what they've done was wrong. And so instead of perpetrators that I've seen in other films or that I expected to confront when I first met these men, instead of denying what they'd done or acting ashamed about it, they boasted. And they at least pretended to be proud, maybe tried to convince themselves that they were proud. And that sense that here was this very recognizably human nexus of trauma and guilt, certainly, because they are, all of the perpetrators, in fact, are human, even if we want to sort of say they're not, on the one hand, and self-deception, lies, stories, ways of talking that glorify and elevate what they've done into something heroic in their minds, offered for me this kind of glimpse into something that I felt was a very profound and simple truth about human evil, which is that the capacity for human evil depends on our ability to lie to ourselves. And I think, in fact, what's disturbing about the films is not that they kind of, as you said, take us to the bottom of humanity, not that they take us to the worst kinds of people, these most shocking crimes, because we're inundated with stories of shocking crimes and awful things happening all over the world. If the films are powerful, it's because even if there's new information in them, because we didn't know about this genocide or we didn't know about this particular political situation of the impunity of the perpetrators in Indonesia, that actually there's a very deep recognition in the impunity, in the self-deception of the perpetrators. So it was really in recognition of that, something universal in this situation of impunity, this sense that maybe it's not the exception to the rule that the perpetrators win, but the rule itself across certainly most of the global South and in many ways the United States too, that led me to spend all these years focusing on this. It was the sense that impunity, which is really what my films are about, might just be the story of our times.
What do you mean your films are about impunity?
Well, I think it's easy to see the films and say, because they challenge you and they provoke you and they make you think a lot of things and you don't necessarily have a ready summary for them. It's easy to say, oh, these are about a genocide in Indonesia 50 years ago. But then you get the sense that they're about the past. They're historical documentaries. They're not. The Act of Killing is about what happens when perpetrators win and remain in power for decades and are able to write the history celebrating what they've done so that they never have to confront the real meaning of what they've done, what it means for the society, for themselves. And then what happens when a whole society is built on the basis of lies, on what corruption becomes inevitable, what thuggery becomes inevitable, how are boastful stories of the killings told by the perpetrators used to keep everyone afraid and therefore silent and quiescent in the face of massive plunder? That's about today. That's about impunity today. and about a regime of fear built on impunity today, something that we have in every American city, that we feel in all sorts of ways in our own society. And the second film is sort of the reverse shot of the first. In a way, it's asking, what is it like, what does it do for human beings, ordinary human beings, for the survivors, for the relatives of the victims, to have to live in such a regime, ruled over by the perpetrators, in the shadow of the men who killed their loved ones? What does it do to us to have to live for 50 years afraid and silent? Again, a story about what it's like to live in a regime of total impunity today. And it's in that sense that the two films are about the present and not about what happened 50 years ago. If they're about the genocide, it's only because in a terrible way, when there's impunity, genocide doesn't end. Because although the killings may stop, people's lives are still being destroyed by fear. And your first question was how I got into this, and I answered it in a kind of abstract way, but very concretely. I first went to Indonesia in 2001 to teach a group of plantation workers how to make a film in which they would document their struggle to organize a union in the aftermath of the Suharto dictatorship, under which unions were illegal and which came to power through the genocide. And I was on this Belgian-owned oil palm plantation, and the Belgian company made the women workers do the supposedly easy work of spraying the pesticides and the herbicides, but they weren't given any protective clothing, and the women were dying of liver failure in their 40s. And one of the first things that the workers did as a fledgling union was to demand protective clothing, and the company responded by hiring this paramilitary group called Panchasila Youth to threaten and attack the workers. And the workers immediately dropped their demands, explaining to me, though this is a matter of life and death for us, our parents and grandparents were killed by this organization, which was in 1965 working for the army and carried out a mass killing of all the union members in this area and across the country, we think. They didn't know exactly what happened nationally. That was really the first I'd heard of the genocide. But more importantly, it was the moment when I realized what was killing these women was not only poison, but fear, and fear today.
You know, it's very heavy, because when you think about this, you've also made a point that when you do your films and when you look into this, on one level, you're telling a story. But on another level, you have a really deep commitment to exposing lies for what they are, is the way you put it. Let's talk about that a little, because what's the importance of that? And what do you mean, exposing lies for what they are? And what impact does that have?
I think that in any system of power, you have those in power telling stories, writing the history, creating patriotic rituals that make whatever the situation is, that the powerful, and from which inevitably the powerful profit, that's why they're in power, these stories make whatever that situation is feel natural, almost immutable, like the natural order of things. And whereas in fact, of course, the situation is anything but natural. And if the situation, if the gross injustices and power imbalances that you have in Indonesia feel natural and immutable, then it feels like it's pointless to try and change them. How can you change it? This is the way the world is and should be. And so it is very powerful. It is powerful to provide an alternative account, to say, well, actually, the official history says this, but in fact, this happened. But it's even more powerful if at the same time you can show how the official history is constructed, so that you never hear it the same way again. It never works the same way again. That's why there's this very important moment in The Act of Killing, which I think is really why all of the perpetrators panic in the look of silence when confronted by a survivor. It's a very powerful moment when one of the death squad leaders says to another, if we succeed in making this film, it will show the world that all of the propaganda's a lie, that what we did was wrong, and that, in fact, the victims of the genocide were innocent. And there was this dawning awareness that by creating these dramatizations in The Act of Killing, where they're, in a sense, reenacting or going through the motions of creating the lies, the architecture of the lies, the structure of the lies was being exposed. This sounds abstract and complicated because I'm not putting it well, but I suppose a very simple example that we all know is the Emperor's New Clothes. The child comes in and says, look, the king is naked. And he doesn't just call attention to the truth, which would probably not have much effect. What he's doing is, by calling attention to the truth in that way, in that context, he's actually, and what makes his intervention so impactful, he's calling attention to the fact that everyone's been lying to themselves, and they can no longer do it anymore. They can no longer repeat the lie without it getting stuck in their throat. And so everything changes, or can change, if you can not only provide a more truthful account or an alternative account, but also show how the stories that the powerful have told to justify, to naturalize their power, are in fact created.
What does that have to do with what you were talking about with Werner Herzog about the shock of recognition?
Well, I think that maybe the role of the artist is a little bit like that child in The Emperor's New Clothes, in the sense that even if an artist comes and tells a story or provides information that no one knew about before, and I sort of alluded to this a moment ago, if you tell a story about a genocide you hadn't heard of or a country you hadn't heard of or a phenomenon you didn't know about, or just a fictional story with new characters, what'll make the story impactful, what makes it powerful, is never the new information. Oh, I didn't know that. That might make it interesting. But new information that doesn't fit into a pattern, you just kind of jettison it. It's hardly even interesting. What makes it impactful and powerful is not the new story. Oh, I didn't know this story. This is important. What makes it powerful and impactful is the recognition, the way that the story confirms something that you knew, that you already knew, but had maybe been too afraid or too uncomfortable to talk about or found had no words for. So like the child in The Emperor's New Clothes who points at something everyone knew, look, the king is naked. Mm-hmm. It's powerful because of the recognition of truth. And we may, as nonfiction filmmakers, go out into the world and discover new stories and bring them to light, but that's not what makes our work powerful. What makes it powerful is the resonance with mm-hmm. deep truths that we've been afraid to acknowledge, or worse, that we've lied to ourselves, pretended to ourselves, like the people in the story of The Emperor's New Clothes. We've lied to ourselves by pretending that we didn't know.
So the shock of recognition actually is a positive thing in terms of people being able to, one, just understand what's happened or really put it together fully in their heads, but also then able to act in relation to that.
Oh, it's essential, because you cannot solve a problem, you cannot address a problem you're too afraid even to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, why don't people acknowledge the problems that, first of all, at some level they already know, and second of all, they pose us enormous challenges, sometimes even to our very survival. And if we don't acknowledge them, the consequences could be dire indeed. I'm talking about continuing with our present carbon economy, even though we know the abyss into which it's leading us. Why don't we acknowledge those problems? And I think fear is a big part of it. In the case of the perpetrators in my films, fear of guilt is a big part of it. If the perpetrators were to acknowledge really the simple fact of what they'd done, how would they live with themselves? And for the survivors, how would they go about a life, building a family, continuing to raise their children amidst the awareness that all around them are the people who killed them and could kill them again?
And, you know, the thing is, though, is I keep thinking about this because it's sort of like, once you know, I mean, look, what happened in Indonesia was monstrous. And we see it, similar things happening on smaller scales, sometimes approaching the same thing. We've seen it in various countries in Africa. We've seen what the U.S. has done in the Middle East and what it's given rise to and all this, and the terrible suffering in the world. And that if people actually, if there is this sort of recognition of things, if there's a recognition of what actually, what's really happening and who's responsible, it does seem to me that there's a point where it's not just that you can understand a thing, but we really need, look, for me, in the world today, we need some people who are going to stand up and say, no more. We can't go this way. But that requires having access to the kind of things that you're putting forward. That's what really struck me about this thing about the shock of recognition, the idea of actually being able to move into this. So, I mean, it was very heavy to me to think about that, because without that understanding, without the understanding of what's real and what isn't, what's a lie and what isn't, we can live our entire life following a lie. And all it takes is one moment for that lie to crack open, to break, to be exposed. And things can change dramatically. And that's what really struck me about what, because I watched both of your films a number of times and I kept thinking, all right, this is some heavy stuff. Even watching the one relative in The Look of Silence, the uncle who was responsible for actually
sending out all the prisoners to be killed.
Yeah, including
his own nephew.
Yeah. And when that happens, when that breaks open, there's a certain thing that, yes, there's anguish in a certain part that I imagine his family feeling like anguish, but then also there's a certain opening that once people know the truth, that they can actually then refashion their thinking and move to change things.
Well, yes, and in The Look of Silence, actually, it's an important example, because what's really powerful about the scene with the uncle is, first of all, that Adi, who loved his uncle, the main character, didn't know his uncle's role. But then in the next scene, you get the feeling that Adi's mother, who we love very much, she's one of the great characters in the film, that she did know, and that she couldn't allow herself to know it. She knew it, but had to pretend or convince herself or make herself feel that she didn't know it. And Adi and I really discussed, should you not tell this story to your mother? What if it's too much for her? And he said, no, it's so important. She has put all her hopes in me as being a kind of reincarnation of my dead brother. And I cannot betray that by continuing to support the lies which have actually created the kind of, almost like the padded cell walls in this prison of silence. Yes, the lies make it easier. And again we hear the survivors say, let the past be past. But Adi never accepts that because he recognizes that they're saying it out of fear. Just as the perpetrators, when they say let the past be past, are saying it as a threat, suggesting that the past isn't there. It's a gaping wound in the present from which everyone is looking away, and that it'll never heal until everyone turns around, looks at it, addresses it, mm-hmm. and says, okay, this is what happened. How shall we live together? And I think that it's exactly that that embodies the sense that we need to not just say, look at all these terrible things that are happening, but actually make an audience recognize the myriad ways in which all the time we're lying to ourselves to make our world easier. And also make the audience feel what the terrible consequences of those lies are.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Joshua Oppenheimer. Josh is the writer-director of the film The Look of Silence, the follow-up to his original film, The Act of Killing. Both films tell the story of the Indonesian government's slaughter of up to a million Indonesian revolutionaries and progressive people back in the 1960s.
Now, I want to move on to another section, because you also make a big point, and I know you made it in your discussions with Werner Herzog at Sundance, but you've made it elsewhere too. This point about the need to distinguish documentary filmmaking from journalism. Because, like, if people look at your films, there's a pull to say, he went in, he's playing the role of a journalist who's actually using this form of documentary film. But actually, you argue that there's a difference between, and it's important that people recognize that, a difference between documentary filmmaking and journalism. Let's talk about that.
Well, I think I want to maybe soften the difference, because I really do feel, out of deference to great journalism, that great journalists actually, in the way they craft their stories, are creating works of art. And create works of art that touch us, again, because they take us beyond the presenting of new information into this moment of recognition where we see ourselves in the story, where we feel this is us, where the story is not a window onto a far off or remote or new phenomenon that we didn't know about before, but a mirror in which we're confronting ourselves. So I think great journalists can be and often are artists. But journalism in the first instance has to concern itself with going out and getting that information that's new, recontextualizing it so that it can be put to use in the service of some public good. Ideally, at least, that's what journalism should be. And in that sense, if it has, I feel like it has to, at the first instance, shock us with the new. It has to somehow take this new information and shock us into saying, well, this is inconsistent with the values that we have or that I have, and we have to do something about this. Whereas the role of the artist is somehow, first and foremost, this thing we talked about a moment ago, the shock of recognition, is to deliver a shock of the familiar. That uncanny sense of recognition where you feel, oh yes, or rather, oh no, that's really me, isn't it? It's not so much that journalism and nonfiction film are opposed to each other. If someone says my films are works of journalism, I'm comfortable with that. But my first commitment is to creating that experience of recognition long before it's about looking for the important story that the world didn't know about.
What I wanted to ask you is this point again around the relationship between journalism and, look, I spent my life as a journalist, right? And actually a literary journalist, in terms of even, you know, I traveled through South Africa when the rebellions were going on and wrote stories that were actually beautiful stories that also laid bare some things, both positive and negative, in terms of what was going on among the people, but also the regime and everything that was being carried out there. And I've done that in many other places, many other subjects and whatnot. But I recognize in your film, for instance, there's a difference between someone who would be writing a story. And again, it's not that clear when it comes to literary journalism and the art form of documentary filmmaking. And the thing is that documentary filmmaking is an art. And it's an art, it's actually
It's not like, oh, well, it's sort of the newspaper of the artistic world or something. It's actually something that has to, again, I kept thinking, the image you have of the guy wearing the...
The Phoropter.
Yeah, yeah. Incredible. To this day, I think of that, it pops up in my head, it's always there. Because it just concentrated something about everything you were doing in terms of looking into things, in terms of just the layers between the person and reality. It just really struck me as that, and every time I see it, I get something new out of it. And that seems to have something to do with documentary filmmaking. You actually can use different things to bring the truth to people than you do when you're doing journalism. Journalism, you really do have to be rooted in right now. You have to, everything almost has to be right there. Well, you can use imagery and whatnot, but you still don't have that freedom to, or the necessity to, practice this as an art form.
Well, I think that what I'm trying to do is not to report what happened while I was shooting the film, certainly, and also not to report what I discovered, what important information I learned while shooting the film, which might lead to a journalistic or historical approach where I'm saying this is what I learned happened in 1965, and these are the conditions the survivors are living under ever since, and these are the conditions of the perpetrators who live around them with impunity. But rather, to try and explore how the human beings involved with this situation live with this situation, cope with this situation. What is the lived experience? What is the phenomenon? What is the feeling like for a family that lives for 50 years surrounded by all the men who killed their son, unable to talk about it? It's not the fact of that that I want to report. It's that I want the audience to be immersed in that family, to feel what, I want you to feel like you are Adi, or your brother's Adi, and his parents are your parents or your grandparents, his children or your grandchildren, and I want you to feel that in your body, in your stomach, in your, and for that, of course, one uses metaphor, and a metaphor in film and in any art, I think, should always have a kind of enduring mystery. Otherwise, it's merely a symbol. It should never be fully explicable. And I think the shot of the eyes that you talk about with the red glasses framing them is maybe one of the metaphors in the film. And in this case, I'd say sort of roughly it's a metaphor for blindness. Mm-hmm. But it is also somehow, it is still inexplicable. It still bears a mystery, in part because there's all this behind Inong, the perpetrator's blind eyes, is all this kind of, is this uncertainty and this danger and this fear and this anger. And I feel that what I try to do while shooting is to take a long journey with participants, a very intimate journey that hopefully will transform all of us, not just them, but me too, where again and again, we create situations together where we're all pushed beyond our comfort zone in order to reveal the most important human truths, by which I mean the feelings that human beings have in such situations, allowing us to understand how humans create these situations within the overall safe space of making the film. And then I try to, in the editing, not as mentioned earlier, not to report on what happened, but to condense, to distill whatever I discovered on this journey into a kind of poetic and immersive experience for the audience.
Now, you've also talked a lot about journalism that pretends to understand, but really seeks only to condemn.
Yeah, I think that there's a kind of narrative framework, particularly in American storytelling, but it's certainly worldwide, where we divide the world into good guys and bad guys. Because of that, it can feel natural enough to just compile lists of crimes, compile lists of wrongdoings, name them, make it clear that we think they're wrong, and condemn them, and pretend that we've dealt with it, pretend that we've somehow analyzed, understood, figured out how and why this can happen. And there's this confusion of condemnation for comprehension. It's as though condemnation has such a kind of moral force, it kind of creates this kind of illusion of deliverance or expiation, just to have named and condemned, that we forget that we haven't actually understood anything by doing that. It's all based on this falsehood that the world is divided into good guys and bad guys, what I think of as the Star Wars morality. And if we could acknowledge that that's a lie, and that in reality, the human being is immensely complex, and there's not even a good part and a bad part. Sometimes the good part, the part can be involved in the practice of evil. For example, in the perpetrators in Indonesia, it's because the perpetrators feel guilty and are desperate and afraid of their guilt, and therefore desperate not to admit it, that they boast and continue insisting on the victor's history and on the heroism of what they did. It's out of guilt that they do that. So it's out of their knowledge that what they did was wrong.
I know what you're saying, but there's also,
in the world. There are people who are running things. There are people who, the people who ran Indonesia, who are running it today. You know, there's people who, when they committed that genocide, it wasn't a mistake. It was very well thought out in a certain sense. And they did that, I think. There's a compulsion on their part. It's not that they feel guilty, even if they do feel guilty, but you look at those two guys that were centerpieces in The Look of Silence that went down to the river and laughingly told the stories about the bodies and what they did to people before they threw them into the river and all this. And you're thinking, okay, what motivated them? And in a sense, there is a bigger thing going on about that genocide. In a lot of ways, was rooted in the need for that regime to establish itself in power.
Absolutely. Yeah. What motivated people was the need for power and was a desire for power and wealth and prestige and position. And that goes all the way up to the Johnson administration. There's a clip in The Look of Silence where we learn that Goodyear was harvesting the rubber that goes into its tires and into condoms using slaves drawn from death camps, which is what German corporations were doing only 20 years earlier at Auschwitz. And this should give all of us pause and lead all of us to question to what extent might American involvement, American support, American participation in this genocide not really have been motivated by ideological anti-communism, but rather to what extent might ideological anti-communism have been an excuse, a pretext, just as the perpetrators have their excuses and pretexts, to justify what was really murderous corporate plunder, what was really a campaign of slaughter on behalf of their colleagues in business, on behalf of the men who make campaign contributions to them, on behalf of the companies from which the lawyers in the State Department and in the White House came just before the Johnson administration came to power. And so this revolving door between business and government in the United States is, of course, what I'm referring to. And my point is that, of course, there's venal motivations, but there's also self-deception, because no one, whether it's the people in the Johnson administration or the two men who go down to the river and are giving the thumbs up in the V for Victory where they killed, no one can live with the fact that they did that just out of greed. Mm-hmm. And I think that the perpetrators in The Look of Silence and in The Act of Killing, every single one of them lives their life in kind of manic flight from a cloud of guilt and shame that follows them everywhere they go. And by day, they outrun it. And at night, when they stop to sleep, it catches up to them and gets into their dreams and gives them nightmares. But because they've never been removed from power, they still have available a victor's history that celebrates what they've done. And so they do the human thing that you or I would do if you were in their positions. They take their bitter, rotten memories and they try to sugarcoat them in the sweet language of the victor's history. That is to say, they talk about it in heroic terms to justify what they've done. And you might think, well, why then do they talk about these awful things so happily? The cutting off of heads, the drinking of bloods, the terrible details. It's precisely because those are exactly the bitter memories that they need to sugarcoat and make easier to swallow. And this, I think, is the only thing that accounts for why they relentlessly, compulsively boast about the most inappropriate details. If they were just psychopaths or monsters and mock sort of scheming demons, then they would know better than to boast about the awful stuff. They would say, yes, we were heroes and we exterminated the communists and that was wonderful, which is what the official history says. The official history is mute, written by the commanders of the genocide and their intellectual apologists. It's mute, it's silent about the actual killing. But the perpetrators, the actual executioners, don't have the luxury of being silent about the killing because they did it. And those memories haunt them. So they desperately try and take those bitter, rotten memories and sugarcoat them with this official history. And that's what accounts for the boasting. Mm-hmm.
So one more question. You've also said that you can't divorce great filmmaking from empathy. You're starting to speak to it now in terms of what you've just said, but there seems to be something very important in terms of filmmaking itself concentrated in that statement.
Well, you asked me at the very beginning how I got into this, and I said, well, I felt when I encountered the boasting of the perpetrators that there was something unfathomable but important here. How can you understand this phenomenon? How can I understand this phenomenon? I can say, okay, the perpetrators are in power. This is a symptom of impunity. I can come to that conclusion pretty quickly. But then why are they boasting? And if I can see that the boasting is keeping everyone in the society afraid, so it's of profound political importance, it's the mechanism of a regime of fear, the question of, well, why are they boasting becomes all the more urgent. Mm-hmm. And to understand why a human being is boasting, we have to try and get into their head and empathize. And I know what it's like to boast. I sometimes do boast. I'm not proud of it. But when I do, I know it's never because I feel genuinely proud or happy with what I've done. It's always because I feel small and I'm trying to show others that I've done something important. It's like a little bird that puffs out its feathers to look bigger because it knows it's small. So this is just one example of how empathy works in filmmaking. My films, the whole questioning, the whole attempt to understand our human world by getting into the heads of the people who make our world. Mm-hmm. That's really the project of important filmmaking, and that requires empathy. And I would say beyond that, that everything we talked about recognition, that the purpose of a great film ought to be, or is, if it's great, to shock the viewer through the recognition, through the familiar, not through the new, to make the viewer feel, oh no, yes, of course, that's me, but I hadn't realized it. Well, for that, the filmmaker has to bring the viewer very, very close to the people she's filming and to make you feel what is it like to be that person. And the filmmaker also has to be very close to the audience and to empathize with what the audience will feel at every moment in the film, taking into account the fact that the audience is diverse and will come from all over the world and come from different backgrounds. And there has to be a trust that all human beings share something. And that no human being, no matter how demonic the things they've done, no human being's actually a demon beyond our understanding. And that may be an ideal, that might not be true 100% of the time, but I've taken that pretty far in my work. And I think that in that sense, empathy is the basis for everything we do, from the creation of characters to the creation of situations with nonfiction characters where you feel they will open up, to finding out how to photograph and edit those situations so the viewer is immersed in it and feels them in their skin. Empathy is the essential ingredient, I think, of filmmaking and art. And I think the problem is with, as I talked about it earlier, the Star Wars morality, no offense to George Lucas at the moment, but the problem with the Star Wars morality, of course, is that it's predicated on a failure of empathy. It's predicated on a willingness to say, okay, for dramatic expedience and to reassure the audience that it is good, we will empathize with these people who we will depict dishonestly, and we will not empathize and rather condemn and fail to comprehend these people who we will also depict dishonestly.
All right, Joshua Oppenheimer, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right, you've been listening to an interview I did with filmmaker Joshua Oppenheimer about his latest film, The Look of Silence. And The Look of Silence is the follow-up to his first film, which is The Act of Killing. And both of these films tell the story of the genocidal slaughter by the Indonesian government against communists and other progressive people in Indonesia. We're talking about up to 1 million people dead for their political opposition to the Indonesian regime and U.S. imperialism. That brings us to the end of yet another show, and I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank Brian Oakes and Claire Gillis. I also want to thank Joshua Oppenheimer, and I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my intern, Alex Brenner. And again, thanking each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Blind eyes of justice.